Hi, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. As you may know, on this program, we ask poets to pick a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss. Then we ask them to read a poem of their own that's been published in the magazine. Today, my guest is Vijay Seshadri. His work has been honored with the James Lachlan Award and the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry, and he recently became poetry editor of the Paris Review. Vijay, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So the poem you've chosen to read today is The Moon and the Yew Tree by Sylvia Plath. What about this poem struck you as you were looking through the archive?
Well, it struck me that the New Yorker had published this poem in a two-page spread after she had died, right before the American edition of Ariel came out. And I thought that was fascinating. And I've always looked at that spread, which has a bunch of other poems, including this one. And this is the very last one on that two-page spread. And this one kept coming back to me with a certain insistence because of purely technical qualities that have reinterested me in it. I mean, I've been reading Plath since, you know, the early 70s, and I know the poems well, and sometimes they just dazzle me, and sometimes I don't read them for 5 or 6 years. But it had been on my mind, and I had been reading this and other poems in Ariel recently because of certain aspects of rhythm and sonic body and stanzaic structure that I thought would be useful for me.
Well, let's hear the poem. Here is Vijay Seshadri reading The Moon and the Yew Tree by Sylvia Plath.
The Moon and the Yew Tree. This is the light of the mind, cold and planetary. The trees of the mind are black. The light is blue. The grasses unload their griefs on my feet as if I were God, prickling my ankles and murmuring of their humility. Fumi spiritus mists inhabit this place, separated from my house by a row of headstones. I simply cannot see where there is to get to. The moon is no door. It is a face in its own right, white as a knuckle and terribly upset. It drags the sea after it like a dark crime. It is quiet with the O gape of complete despair. I live here. Twice on Sundays the bells startle the sky, 8 great tongues affirming the resurrection. At the end they soberly bong out their names. The yew tree points up. It has a Gothic shape. The eyes lift after it and find the moon. The moon is my mother. She is not sweet like Mary. Her blue garments unloose small bats and owls. How I would like to believe in tenderness. The face of the effigy, gentled by candles, bending on me in particular its mild eyes. I have fallen a long way. Clouds are flowering, blue and mystical over the face of the stars. Inside the church, the saints will be all blue, floating on their delicate feet over the cold pews, their hands and faces stiff with holiness. The moon sees nothing of this. She is bald and wild, and the message of the yew tree is blackness, blackness and silence.
That was a very powerful reading. That was The Moon and the Yew Tree by Sylvia Plath, which was originally published in the August 3rd, 1963 issue of the magazine. So tell me what struck you beyond of the rhythm. You were mentioning the rhythm was really important. I see it all over, but I'm curious what you see.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about poetry, I think we're dealing with complicated ideas of rhythm and sonic effects, which we don't really have a precise understanding of. And as poets, we probably don't want to have a precise understanding of them.
Sure.
You know, One of the things that always struck me about Plath is that when she dazzled me, I could catch her music. And when she didn't dazzle me, when sort of the poems were opaque to me, and this has happened in my reading her for over 40 years now, you know, I couldn't catch the music. And then finally, you know, maybe about 10, 12 years ago, I started catching the music all the time. And in this case, with this particular poem, there were two things that interested me about it, that the musicality is so subdued, but it's there, and you sort of have to reach for it. And it's because she makes the tone of the poem so clinical. If you look at it, she's writing, she's almost like a clinician writing down the notes of her despair in some way, you know?
Well, I feel like she's also declaring in ways that I don't think you always see in a poem. The moon is no door.
Right.
You know, it is a face in its own right. Everything feels like settled and proven, but then she constantly is changing that.
Yeah.
So the moon is this, the trees of the mind are black, the light is blue. Mm. I mean, it's very simple, declarative.
Exactly.
But there's something very complicated, a kind of undersong coursing through the poem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing about this poem is that she's backing away from the sonic obligations of the poem rather than, you know, driving into them. She's retreating from them and letting kind of the sonic obligations somehow follow her. And
she's sort of dragging them after her like a dark crime.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's such a sense of gothic ominousness coursing through. I mean, you know, some of these images are familiar and some aren't. And I think, you know, White as a Knuckle takes this kind of cliche of being white knuckled and turns it, you know, pulls it apart.
Sure.
And she does that throughout the poem, sort of pulls things apart, puts them back together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just a tragic poem. It's a horror poem in some way. You know, Halloween.
Yeah,
right?
It feels apt for the season.
Yeah,
it's autumnal, but it's also more stark wintry. You know, like you picture this is the light of the mind, cold and planetary, which is so different. It's not lunar only. It's larger. It's global. You know, and that's she somehow manages to make it not sort of the fallacy that, you know, the rain is crying for me.
Right.
She somehow is sort of showing you that tug that we're talking about.
Yeah. No, it's an astonishing achievement, I think. And it was particularly useful to me because, you know, I think this is also true of your work. We both tend to kind of turn the poem from line to line. You know, we have that sense of that downward movement of the poem as opposed to the severe end stop poem and the rigor of the stanza in some way. She's exactly the opposite, which is why it was so useful for me technically, just to kind of feel how solid everything is, how everything is like a headstone in its place, you know, sort of, you know. Each syllable is sort of unmovable, and each line is unmovable, and each sentence seems unmovable.
But they seem artfully arranged as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I love those lines. With the O gape of complete despair, I live here. Those little slant rhymes and blue and pews toward the end.
Right.
Even holiness and silence.
Yeah.
Those S sounds. She really nails that feeling and sound.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we tend to think of Sylvia Plath as a poet of power, and we don't sufficiently understand, you know, how sensitive and subtle she can be.
I mean, I feel like people sometimes understand her too much as only sensitive. And here, I feel like she says, the grasses unload their griefs on my feet as if I were God.
Right.
You know, there's a kind of proclamatory quality that I feel is a claim of the import of this feeling and the import of this scene that I, you know, she reaches for Christian myth. She reaches for Mary. She reaches for sort of resurrection. And, you know, I remember reading dutifully in high school that yew trees were a symbol of immortality.
Sure,
and so there's this kind of really, she's really in British and American poetry's traditions.
Sure.
But she's reckon shop.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, she's deconstructed all of that stuff. I mean, what would be the religious source of this poem? I mean, you couldn't figure it out, right? I mean, somehow, you know, in high school, they want you to hunt allusions and metaphors and stuff like that. So they tell you about that. But somehow it's not even a subversion of Christianity. It's not even a post-Christian world. It's a post-Christian world, you know, which retains some of the power of those religious images without kind of, you know, ever interpreting that power. But in terms of her sensitivity, yeah, she's considered psychologically sensitive, and of course she is. But I think what I was talking about was rhetorical sensitivity, you know, because she seems to be a powerful rhetorician, but we don't tend to think of her as a delicate rhetorician so much, and she actually is. And the perfect example for that is, for me, in that regard, is the turn in the poem, which is so silent. It comes in the third stanza. The moon is my mother. She is not sweet like Mary. Her blue garments unloose small bats and owls. And you have that declaration that you were talking about there. And then the subtle shift, which is where the feeling of the poem kind of rises for a moment. How I would like to believe in tenderness. And that kind of comes out of nowhere in this kind of very stately rhetorical movement of simple sentences and declarations, you know, and that's the turn in the poem. But you hardly notice it, you know.
Yeah, no, it kind of blows by.
Yeah. You know, it's indicated mostly by the dash in some way, you know, and then you
realize, love a dash. Yeah. I mean, you know, she's sort of, it's such a, it's the private moment in the poem in a way.
Yeah.
How I would like to believe in tenderness.
Yeah.
And then it's the tenderness of the effigy, which right. is even not like a physical body, but sure. this metaphoric
sure.
tenderness.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. You know, it's not the raging Sylvia Plath. It's not the angry Sylvia Plath. It's the Sylvia Plath who has almost been completely exhausted by despair, you know, and yet can produce this poem. You know, there's a...
But there's a wildness in the poem. And there's something about that wildness that I think, for me, there's a tension between the declarative part, the end stopped, as you're talking about, and the wildness that's roaring beneath. And it's something I see in Elizabeth Bishop, who we've talked about for many years.
Right, sure.
And, you know, that's what makes Bishop, for instance, very powerful, is people sometimes try to write poems like Bishop, but they're like animal poems,
right.
as opposed to poems about this roaring, raging thing just held together by form.
Sure.
And you feel a little of that here, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure she read Bishop during this time, you know.
Yeah.
She was reading everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And, I mean, there's detail, you know, just like a classic Bishop poem. And, you know, very real specificity. But it's all pointing in the opposite direction of Bishop, you know.
What do you think Bishop is pointing?
Well, I mean, I think Bishop has a strong sense of a cosmic order, you know. And it really reveals itself in her... You know, the last book, all those poems that came out in The New Yorker in the 70s. And she's a classical writer who's creating a classical order. And Sylvia Plath is absolutely individuated. You know, it's very, very hard to see her as an exemplar of anything but her own situation and condition.
But I think she's speaking for a lot of people, for people. I mean, readers are drawn to her, I think, because she speaks of, in an individual way,
right.
but of this tradition that some would say was exhausted. Mm-hmm. You know, and in a way, this poem is taking apart, as we talked about, but also sort of looking at the pieces
yeah.
of the English poetic tradition.
Sure.
I think Bishop is interested in saying that she's going to... you know, not lose that. But sometimes she does, you know. I think the effort is marked, I yeah. think, in Bishop, and is part of the power.
Yeah.
Here I find, you know, the power is just in those leaps,
yeah.
you know, and in the willingness to just say it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, one of the differences between them is what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, Bishop is much more liquid.
Hmm.
You know, the poem is flowing. You know, you can feel its flow. And Plath is using white space, and she's using enjambment in a lot of her poems, but she's always pulling the poem back, kind of into its phrase and into its stanza in some way, and into a kind of internal energy that you can't quite get a hold of. You know, there are poets who kind of, they look at you and they talk to you. And there are poets who sort of, you know, look sideways and you're sort of overhearing them. There are some poets who turn their back on you and you don't hear them at all. They're muttering. You know, the late poems of Celan are like that, you know. It's like there's this guy on the stage with his back to the audience and you can't quite make out what he's saying, you know. And this is not a poet who is facing us. She's facing something else.
Plath, you know? You mean?
Plath, yeah.
You think she's sideways or do you think she's Miles Davis turned away?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's that Miles Davis aspect of her, you know, and
Well, she ends with silence, you know, which is, you know, Miles Davis in a silent way. He's just as interested in those gaps between the notes.
Sure.
I feel that here with her.
Sure. I mean, Miles is always swallowing, you know, in some way, and she is doing that too. And it doesn't have to do with avant-garde or anything like that. If you listen to someone like Eric Dolphy, he's full frontal in some way. He's like really coming at you to communicate something, you know, and not asking you to come to him. And she's asking us to come to her in some way that Elizabeth Bishop, I don't think, is. Sylvia Plath in these poems is not a social poet. I mean, there's just no way you can kind of construe that.
Do you think it's like Dickinson in that way?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some Dickinson poems, but some Dickinson poems are very transparent to the reader.
Yeah, and, but there's a terror that Dickinson is happy to tell you about, or happy to describe.
Sure.
You know, maybe she's not telling it to you as your to use your formulation. She's not facing you.
Right.
But there's a pleasure even in that I think she takes that I think is really remarkable. I feel it in Plath. I couldn't always point to where it is.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just in that dash after How I Would Like to Believe in Tenderness.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, what a moment, you know? And the discipline it takes to underplay that, to keep it so sotto voce, you know, and not kind of, you know. I mean,
it's
hard. Really...
It's hard. If you're Miles Davis, it's hard not to just play that
right?
The first thing or your Coltrane and you know, the first bars. Wouldn't you just blow it all out?
Yeah,
I would.
Right. Yeah.
And then waste it. And, you know, you're right that there's a level of control and patience.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing about the poem is it does have this patience. I'm curious about the sort of understated or maybe it's overstated blackness in the poem, the blueness. There's all this color, which feels like more than just color, of course.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a kind of outer space quality.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the gothic in it. She's not things are not things.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a Carlos Williams poem in that. The things are all that there is. There's way more happening than the things themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I just saw the new version of Halloween. Did you see it? Jamie Lee Curtis is an old woman.
No, I didn't see it.
I was thinking, you know, I think I was watching it this weekend after a period of frustration. It was on cable, maybe HBO. And I, you know, kept coming back to this poem when I was watching it.
The difference between horror and the gothic.
Yeah,
I know. It's thin.
Yeah.
But, you know... There is, you know, we were talking about order. There is an order in the Gothic. You know, there is a
sense
to be made. It's not only human sense. You know, the natural world will pull your mansion down.
Right.
You know, the heart will still beat beneath the floorboards. But it is a sensible, vengeance-filled, ripe with meaning world that is at risk always because, you know, the world is risky.
Sure.
All right. Well, in the January 1st, 2019 issue of the magazine, The New Yorker published your poem, Cliffhanging, which you'll read for us in a moment. Before you do, is there anything you want us to know about the poem?
Well, the reason I chose the Plath poem was that I was thinking of reading this. And in some sense, this might sound crazy, but there was a certain point at which I became terrified of the stanza break. These are the kind of neuroses of the poet, right? You know, like, you know, that white space between, you know, one stanza and the other seemed to be this vast gap that I couldn't really negotiate. And I felt comfortable writing slabs. And I said, wow, this is crazy. I got to get over this. And I went back to Plath. And I went back to this poem specifically, The Moon and the Yew Tree, and sort of recognized the solidity of the stanza and the value of not making the movement of the poems liquid, of sort of pulling back and end-stopping the lines and keeping a certain sort of solidity to both line and stanza. So that was kind of the underlying formal consideration of this poem. And I wanted the sort of rhetorical and emotional aspects of the poem to fall into line with that. And I mean, I don't think you can quite hear it, but I definitely saw it because I write for the page and not necessarily for the ear primarily, you know. And,
well, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Yeah.
Here's Vijay Seshadri reading his poem, Cliffhanging.
Cliffhanging. The forces out to kill us with their benevolence are more crazed now than they were when you were alive. And more focus, too. Our ingratitude excites them. They're bubbling with remedies. Their providential impulses are a nimbus of knives. Their need to tell us they love us, with all their love in vain. You said before you died that this would happen. Thanks for the warning. You didn't let me know, though, that even our phantom selves would come after us, crawling out of the poems we made. They don't care about the transparent skin we wrapped them in, so they could watch their organs pulsing within. All they know is that we made their eyes too bright. They see more than they can stand, more than we ever could or would. They see the unending savagery that we could never really bear to see. And so we consigned our sight to them. They hate us for it. They've cut the phone lines and are chainsawing the front door. I'm a little worried about myself because all this hostility from every quarter bothers me, much less than it should. Why the disconnect? I can't figure it out. And it's long past time to take precautions. The great wave that breaks through the crust of the world is rising and rising and lifting me far inland, only to suck me back and drop me dangling by one arm on the edge of the half-eaten cliff. I won't let myself fall, but I don't want to pull myself up. I'm ambivalent. I'm ambivalent forever now. But if you were here, looking down on me and saying, grab my hand, I would, I know, I surely would.
That was Cliffhanging. So, wow, Vijay, that poem, I've read it, I know it, but to hear it...
You bought it.
Yes. And to see it, you can see why I picked it, hearing it aloud. It's so powerful. I was thinking when I was reading it again and hearing you read it, that it was an elegy, but not just for a person. Though the you comes across as someone who is no longer here, who the speaker is missing.
Yeah.
You said before you died that this would happen. Thanks for the warning. You didn't let me know, though, that even our phantom selves would come after us. And what I love that turn in that second stanza. And as you mentioned before reading the poem, if the poem had been, not at stanzaed, mm-hmm. that would get lost, I think, this turn in the middle, this moment, this extended kind of riff and metaphor off these poems coming to life. But as in a horror movie, they're kind of zombie-like.
Right.
We've made their eyes too bright. They see more than they can stand, more than we ever could or would. They see the unending savagery.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it is about a person. And it's someone you know, Tom Lux, who was, you know, a great friend to me from the time I was 19 on. And, you know,
a terrific poet and
wonderful force in the world.
Yeah.
And a wonderful friend and kind of a wonderful teacher to a lot, you know, a mentor to many, many people. You know, not just me, but, you know, a whole host of people. And so the poem, in some sense, I don't think I write poems about poetry usually, you know, but this is really a poem that's also about poetry. I mean, it's a kind of intersection of a friendship and a faith in something, a faith in a craft and a continuity of an allegiance to something that you do that is sort of essential to your being. And that, I think, for all poets, is transmitted to us through others, other poets, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a very sort of personal and individual thing. And I suppose it is for many things that people do well, that they come to it through other individuals. And I think Tom was certainly very, very important for me. But I don't think I would have written an elegy for him unless I was thinking about what was happening in the second stanza and the third stanza. You know, the second stanza especially.
That's what you said before you died, this would happen, and ends with that chain song, that amazing horror movie image.
Right, yeah, yeah. That, you know, that ourselves, you know, are kind of coming after us. And the ambiguity of sort of the imaginative life in relationship to the real life, that in some sense we engage things in our poetry that we don't quite ever engage in the world, and we use poetry to deflect that. Whether that's true or not, it was a nice trope to work there, and I think I sort of wanted to say something about the savagery. But that's all I could say, that it was, you know, we see the endless savagery, right?
And is that of the poem or of the world?
Of the world, yeah. The savagery of the world that we somehow filter through our poems in some way if we're serious, but that's not the same as actually confronting it. And so there's that disconnect in everybody's life, I think, whether they're poets or not, between, you know, their moral recognitions and their human activity, which is quotidian and has to be, and so that kind of transaction is the sort of transaction that was introduced to me through my engagement with literature. And, you know, and Tom Lux was one of the vessels of that engagement. And I think that was the thing I had, you know, like when someone's gone, they're gone, you know. And it's sort of... it's so obvious, you know, but you never really recognize its force until you lose someone, you know.
Yeah.
It's an obvious thing. It's like, I remember after our kid was born, you know, when we took him out for the first time, the baby, you know, my wife, we were driving around the Upper West Side looking for a place to park, and my wife, Suzanne, was looking around at all the people, and she said, "All these people had a mother." And it just blew her mind, right? All these people had a mother, you know, that they were in somebody's belly and they came out. And saying when someone is gone, they're gone, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, yeah, it's so obvious you don't think about it. But
there seems like a tension in the poem between what you're saying, like, when you're gone, you're gone, but also the kind of warning that the dead give and that the poems kind of give.
Right.
There's a kind of, if you listen hard enough, it almost implies, or if you craft the thing well enough, maybe it won't come after us.
Right.
You know, but there's a kind of, I didn't believe it or I wasn't aware of it. You said this, mm-hmm. but, you know, I wasn't quite ready to hear.
Right.
And I think there's almost that with the poems, too. The poems personified in that second stanza, you know, we could never really bear to see, so we consigned our sight to them.
Right.
They, while they are pained by their sight, they actually see better than the poets or than us walking around.
Right.
And that's, there's something really powerful about that, because then in the end, when the speaker is swept away,
right,
and is hanging on literally, who to reach to? And I think there's almost an implied choice that the speaker reaches not necessarily to back to the poems,
right,
but to this person, to
right,
the you, to the beloved, to yeah, the missing.
Absolutely. You know, or the relationship is the important thing, you know, that the relationship is possible, you know, that it can be forged, that it can kind of occur. You know, the poem ends, of course, in the subjunctive mood, if you were here. And so it's not declarative in the sense that, you know.
No, it's not.
It's not declarative. It's subjunctive. But that is actually a kind of state of mind, too.
Yeah,
of course. Subjunctive mood represents a state of mind.
I'm ambivalent. I'm ambivalent forever now.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that it doesn't end there. It ends with this possibility of reaching out.
Sure. Yeah.
And someone being there.
Yeah.
I also love that you smuggled in some Robert Johnson.
Right.
In the end of the first stanza.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, is this a blues, you know, all their love in vain, all my love in vain? Is that part of the matrix that makes up this poem?
Yeah, I mean, I've been throwing in little taglines like that, you know, and you know, and I think Robert Johnson was very important to me because that first stanza is about people like the speaker and like the person who's addressing, who are a little outside of a benevolent social order that's rational, that, you know, is trying to rationalize the world, you know. I mean, Robert Johnson met the devil on that road, right? And that kind of illusion there, it's not just, oh, it came into my head, you know, love in vain, but, you know, his presence is sort of reinforcing the fact that those three persons in that poem, you know, the speaker, the person whom the speaker is talking to, and Robert Johnson are all kind of, you know, see themselves very much as outside the social order.
Hmm. And are they at a crossroads like Johnson sings?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think there's a, it's a romantic idea, right? But it's very much an idea that the blues carries along, which is that the artist is someone who can't and should not be contained by the demands and the strictures of society. And I mean, that's just a frame at the beginning of the poem, but it's very important to establish the link between the speaker and the person the speaker is addressing, you know, and it kind of characterizes them in relationship to social order. And it comes back in the ambivalence, right, at the end.
I think it's more that there's a music beneath it all.
Yeah.
You know, they're knives.
Yeah.
Their providential impulses are a nimbus of knives, a great line. And that sonic quality is part of the horror or part of the landscape. And you also have three stanzas, which like the three-line blues,
right.
You know, there's statement, you know, statement, repeated statement, and then this kind of kicker.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm throwing in a lot of that stuff here and there, just little bits of it, you know.
Well, I guess that's what I would want to sort of end with, is thinking about, you know, what you're working on now. Is that new for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to publish a new book in next fall, and when I was thinking about the book, I kind of was thinking, well, I'm going to write these clear, limpid abstractions, you know, that were really sort of, you know,
wow, you
remarkably
thought that?
Yeah, I did, you know. I mean, not poems like this, which are about death.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know,
exactly.
Like
you thought you would write like something different.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of
like a meadow filled with butterflies and,
or just, you know, like things that were like, you know, Caldermobiles or stuff like that.
Well, that would be wonderful if one could write that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of the image, because I really have always played around with abstraction and never really known what to do with it, but have been very interested. And, you know, instead, the poems I started writing were this was what came. This was the kind of thing that came, and with its sort of expressiveness and its emotion. And I didn't think I was going to write personal poems, first of all. And I am writing personal poems. And what I did was I would kind of import little bits and fragments of songs and stuff like that. And that was the thing that I retained from the earlier idea that, you know, I would have used this Robert Johnson line, but I would have used it in a very abstract context. It would be a little jewel in a sort of abstract setting, you know? And it would be enigmatic, you know. Instead, those things were transposed.
Well, and I'm, for one, I'm happy that you've turned to the personal, because, one can only write when one is writing, you know, and one can write. But I also think there's a quality of what you were talking about, thinking about with Plath, where there's a pulling back, but also a letting go in a way that I really admire in these poems. But, Jace, thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Kevin. This was fun.
Cliffhanging by Vijay Seshadri, as well as Sylvia Plath's The Moon and the Yew Tree, can be found on NewYorker.com. Vijay Seshadri's latest book is 3 sections.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Ropadope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Hannah Eisenman.